This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Thousands of people in the region have already seen or planned to see The Lion King while it's on stage at the Belk this month, but the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center knows that not every child will have the opportunity to see this amazing musical because of the cost involved. We're going to hear about a program that has made that opportunity available for some later in the program. First, we try to assuage your curiosity about all things Charlotte. If you're a newcomer, you may have wondered, given all of the various Sharon Roads that we have. Who is Sharon? Indeed, given Charlotte's road system, you may have wondered why we can't seem to settle on just one name for a road. Even natives may wonder about those giant onion rings sprouting from the corner of Wendover and Randolph. Well, today we get answers to those questions and more. Some of the questions we don't even know about yet, because we hope they'll be coming from you through email, Facebook, or Twitter at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Talks? I can't even get the name of the show out. I'm so curious. Or by phone at 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323, or 800-603-WFAE. To answer all of these questions, we've assembled a panel of wise sages. We call them wise sages. Tom Hanchett is staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Welcome back.
To be here.
Dan Morrill is a professor of history at UNC Charlotte, whose research interests include historic Charlotte. Good to have you back.
Thanks.
And we try to be more excited. And we welcome a newcomer, Sheila Bumgarner. She's been a librarian at the Robinson Spangler Carolina Room at the library since 1988. It's been her job during that time to answer all manner of questions. And this morning she has walked down the street to do so. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, neighbor.
Start out with a question that came in yesterday from Sarah on Facebook. Why do our streets change names so darn much, Tom?
Well, that's a question that we get asked a lot at Levine Museum of the New South, and the answer is actually in our permanent exhibit, which is called Cotton Fields to Skyscrapers, and it's that Charlotte is really Charlotte's more than 200 years old, but a lot of our development is in the 20th century, which was the time of the subdivision. Everybody wanted to have their own little cul-de-sac neighborhood, their own streets, their own special neighborhood, and as those neighborhoods have gotten glued together and the streets have begun to run from neighborhood to neighborhood, no one wants to give up their street name.
But does that include streets like Woodlawn, which is Billy Graham, Woodlawn, Runnymede, Wendover, and Eastway?
Yep.
And also, a lot of people call in and they want to know, why does Fairview become Sardis? Well, Sardis has been there for over 100 years. Most of our community is built around the Presbyterian sister churches, the Sardis community. And Fairview wasn't even there. But if you look where Sardis begins and on a map today and put it on a map like in the 70s, you can see exactly, and Sardis was not about to give up that name.
I actually looked on a map yesterday at that road, and it starts, if you want to put a start on it, down in the eastern part of its origin, with a road called Seacrest Shortcut Road, which becomes Idlewild, which becomes Rama, which becomes Sardis, which becomes Fairview, which becomes Tivola.
Oh, Idlewild was a community, and Rama was a community. And those roads cut through those little communities where they had the store, and that's basically how they connected. They may have been a little bit of a variation of direction, but they're pretty much – those are the historic roads, and they just kept their historic names.
But aren't all communities that have grown a lot in the 20th century, didn't they have the same situation where communities had roads that suddenly connected to new roads? But I don't recall seeing roads change names so many times. Are we special in Charlotte?
Well, I've heard that it's actually the key to Charlotte's growth, that people get here and they can't figure out how to get away, and that's why keep doubling in population every 10, 15 years.
Can't get out of the place.
And a lot of people come here and they're not familiar with the history, and the people who are here, they're not going to give it up. You know, we were Rama. This was Rama Road long before you came here. So.
Well, what about Sharon? Well, there's so many Sharon Roads, Sharon Lane, Sharon Road West, Sharon Road this, Sharon Road that. Who is Sharon?
That was the most popular question when I first came here. And we have a folder at the Robinson Spangler Carolina Room on street and road names. And it comes from the Bible, the Rose of Sharon, the Field of Sharon, or the Rose of Sharon. Mm-hmm. And Sharon, it was a community, and it built up around the Sharon Presbyterian Church. That's where Billy Graham grew up, and they had a high school, and it was a large community. And I'm just assuming that people who, as they moved around, they just took that name with them and named that street. Up until 1950 in Charlotte, you could have streets with the same name. There were two intersections with the same name going in the same directions. And finally, the police department and the fire department in 1950 petitioned the city council, this has to stop. So,
because they wouldn't know where to go.
They would not know where to go.
Well, does that explain Queens and Queens, Providence and Providence?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Sharon Amity Road goes from Sharon Presbyterian Church to Amity Presbyterian Church.
And there was a community called Amity.
And so many of these early names come from an important geographic point on the road. Providence Road, obviously, goes to Providence Presbyterian Church. And, you know, that goes on and on. Sugar Creek Road went by Sugar Creek Presbyterian Church. Craighead Road goes by the grave of Alexander Craighead. So these names become understandable when you know the history. Then it starts making sense. And you're absolutely right that people do not like to give up their names. Have you ever driven around Hickory, North Carolina?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I can't figure that
out. I mean, some guy from either Chapel Hill or North Carolina State came there and said, we have to have a logical road system. Well, it's so logical you can't find your way around. I mean, the streets have no, I mean, in some ways, I think it's great that we ask these questions. How many people ask why Fifth Street has its name?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's great that we have this
Is there a reason
dimension.
The Fifth Street?
Well, it was just an extension. Uptown was a grid.
Right.
Well, it was kind of a crazy grid, but it was a grid. So it was very different in terms of its layout.
Tell me this, because in town, you're right, 3rd, 4th, 5th are numbered streets. And when 3rd leaves town, and I'm going to get this wrong, I think 3rd becomes Providence.
Right.
Yep.
Then it becomes Selwyn.
That's right.
4th becomes Randolph.
Why?
Right.
Well, Randolph is named Randolph because the farmer who had a farm where it ends at Sharon Amity Road was named Randolph. So when they extended that street out, they named it Randolph.
Why not Fifth Street?
Well, you know, I don't
that's
know.
That's Charlotte for it. That's what makes Charlotte unique. And a lot of our streets come from farmers' names or whoever owned the property in that area, like Torrance Street. He owned the land where Presbyterian Hospital was and the park. And that park was the water reservoir. And then it became a park. That was the reservoir for Charlotte, believe it or not. And then the hospital was originally a school for girls. And he sold the property to the Lutheran Church, who built Elizabeth College. And that's where the Elizabeth neighborhood gets its name.
It helps to realize that in the 1890s, which is when streetcars started to sprout the suburbs around the center city, mm-hmm. The whole of Charlotte was contained within the I-277 loop.
Right.
And that's where the grid and that's where the numbered streets are. And the notion behind the suburbs was that you were, you know, the master of your own villa way out there in the country. And you didn't want a city street name.
Ah. All right, put your headphones on because we have a lot of people chiming in or wanting to ask questions. And we'll begin with all people. Here's the name to begin with, Sharon in Huntersville. Welcome, Sharon.
Hey, good morning, everyone. I'm enjoying the conversation, the discussion. But I just wanted to comment. My name again is Sharon. My son's first name is Norman. So when family visits from New York and Jersey, they do notice that all around the city when we point different landmarks, they see the name Sharon over and over and over. And my son even kind of relishes that Norm the Niner, the mascot at UNC Charlotte.
And he has his own lake.
He has his own lake, yeah. He likes to boast about that because he went kayaking on his lake and is a charter school. So it's between the two of us, we really feel that we kind of run the city.
Okay.
All right.
But I did have a question. It's not about the, and I didn't discuss this with your screener, but not about the names of the streets necessarily, but I noticed that there are sometimes cemeteries that just pop up. There's a couple in university, and they don't have a name or any street to it. And I've just found that kind of unique to Charlotte.
The cemetery in at the university area where you're talking about was the cemetery for the county home, which was located in that area. It was a beautiful building, and we have wonderful photographs, which you can see on our website at cmstory.org. And Charlotte's great about a lot of things. Our churches remain, buildings may not, but and the streets where the building was located, you know, that sort of has the connection, mm-hmm. and that'll stay the same. But the cemeteries also, there are strict rules on cemetery removal.
Okay, Sharon, thank you for your call. Dan tweets, Dan, I have a tweet from Jonathan, which I think you can ask. Why does Charlotte not identify with their large local university like Cincinnati or even Columbia? Is it because when UNC Charlotte was built, it was so far out of town at the time that we don't embrace it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Jack Claiborne, who used to be with the Observer, said many people ask him, why is the university out there mm-hmm. and not down here?
Yes.
And I think that, of course, UNCC is a terrific community asset, but it is a new institution, even though I've been there 50 years. I mean, it's a new institution, but I think a great deal of it has to do with the fact that the real power structure, the elite, those who shape ideas and concepts, don't live in Northeast Charlotte. Some do. I'm not putting anybody down, believe me. But I think it's out of the consciousness of most people who live in Southeast Charlotte. You'd be amazed how many people that I run into who have never been to the campus. Maybe the football team's going to change that.
I was going to ask, is this going to be on television?
Maybe that's going to change that. But it's simply out of the general pattern of meandering that most people do.
Well, okay. Also, I think it's because the university is so new, and a lot of people who come here, you know, they graduated from Chapel Hill or State or Duke, and they have allegiances to those schools.
Right.
And I think, you know, maybe in 100, 200 years from now, there will be that connection because by then the university will meet the city more.
Another street question. A caller who couldn't hold says, part of Barclay Downs used to be called Telstar Lane.
No idea. Dumb as a doorpost.
Anybody know?
It has to be a neighborhood that was laid out about 1959 or 1960 when Telstar was the
satellite.
The satellite that carried civilization into space.
All right.
Also, if you have any questions that we can't answer today, don't hesitate to call the Carolina Room. This is what we do every day. We do not mind. This is what we do for a living. And our number is 704-416-0150. We open at 10 o'clock today. Or you can check our website at cmstory.org. A lot of your questions can be answered today.
Shameless plug. We'll let you get that in because it's a nonprofit. We'll also put that information on our website at wfae.org. Before we head to the break, we've got a lot of tweets and emails about this. I'll just throw it out there. Why is Charlotte called the Queen City?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because she was Queen George III, King of England, who came over here and tried to subdue us. I mean,
Charlotte is older than the United States because we're named after the wife of King George, the guy we eventually rebelled against.
It was a political move.
Charlotte's older than Old Salem.
Who had the nickname first, Charlotte or Cincinnati?
Oh, it would be Charlotte because Cincinnati was not formed yet. And Charlotte, they named it after the queen because Charlotte wanted to be the county seat. And so they said, Charlotte Mecklenburg-Strelitz, we'll name it after your consort. And I have a funny story for you about Queen Charlotte after that.
Okay, and I've got a question about Queen Charlotte after the break as well. That's Sheila Bumgardner, who's a librarian with the Carolina Room at the Charlotte Mecklenburg Public Library. Also with us, Dan Morrill with UNC Charlotte, and Tom Hanchett with the Levine Museum of the New South. More Charlotte Miscellany, or Mystery Lady, when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University Charlotte, now offering the Charlotte region with more globally focused and industry-aligned degrees in science, technology, and engineering. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. Proponents say that our new voter ID law is there to lessen voter fraud. And those opposed to it believe it's designed to limit voter rights. So we're going to take a closer look with a panel that includes State Senator Bob Ruscio, the director director of the Mecklenburg Board of Elections, a political reporter, and a political scientist. That's on Monday at 9. And then in the second part of the program, one of the key leaders of the Moral Monday demonstrations talks about what they hope to achieve by bringing those protests to Charlotte. That's all upcoming on Monday here on Charlotte Talk.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Justice Department sues to block the merger of American Airlines and U.S. Airways. North Carolina adopts a new voter ID law, and a judge rejects New York City's stop-and-frisk policy.
Join the news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the history or various miscellany, things you may have wondered about as you have lived here in Charlotte for whatever time you've been here. And you wanted to tell a story about Queen Charlotte. I asked why we're called the Queen City. It's because we're named after Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg in Germany, who was married to King George III.
That's correct. We had a patron call. We get a lot of interesting questions. And she wanted to know when Queen Charlotte came to Charlotte and went down Queens Road West. And, you know, I had to explain to her that it wasn't until Queen Elizabeth II's parents came to America was the first time that a royal family came to America.
Did they go down Queens Road West?
I don't believe so.
I have a question about the Queen Charlotte statue at the airport that some people have asked. It's been temporarily removed because of construction out there. But when it was up there, she was holding her crown on high, but she was bent over at the middle as though somebody had thrown a basketball at her. Or perhaps it's just the reaction that she had to the gut punch from the legislature as they tried to steal the airport from the city. Why is she in that position?
Well, she's actually still around. She's back between the parking decks, the daily parking decks. You can find her there. Raymond Caskey, the sculptor, actually knows the answer to that. The best answer that I've heard from folks who asked the question say that she's running through the metal detector.
I would say artistic interpretation.
You know, I am very interested in public art, and Charlotte has a very interesting collection of public art. Have you ever seen Metamorphosis on Arco Corporate Drive? It is the most...
Is that the one that changes shape all the time?
Yes, and it's this big head, and it spews out water. And, you know, one of the things I'm working on is a couple of documentaries about public art. And if anybody out there knows of really a favorite, unusual piece of public art, I would love for them to call the Historic Landmarks Commission at 376-9115.
You're supposed to have all the answers. That's why we're having you on here. All right, speaking of public art, let's talk about it, because Jennifer on Facebook sent us a question about the big circles. Now, I've referred to them as onion rings. Either way, those are those things that come out of the ground at the corner of Randolph Road and Wendover. What do they symbolize?
Well, I believe they symbolize the Old South. I think they have to do with magnolia leaves and magnolia trees, but... To me, I hear more comments about that. First of all, you have to look at it in a car. You can't really go up and stand beside them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're there to be viewed by a car. They're huge. And, you know, I believe in abstract art. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think abstract's good stuff. But most people have no idea what they are. And I get more negative comments about that piece of public art than almost any in town.
What are they?
Well, they're supposed to be magnolia leaves.
Oh, okay.
They're supposed to be representative of the Old South, you know, sitting and drinking a mint julep under the magnolia tree.
But they're brown.
I have a friend who knows all this stuff, and her name is Google. And I went and I talked to Google, and the project was by a guy named Thomas Sayer, who's an artist out of Raleigh, graduated from Chapel Hill. And what he does is specialize in art that speaks to the land and speaks to the context. And what I remember was when he was creating those, he actually created them on the ground there using some of the dirt, in addition to the concrete or whatever it is that they're made out of. Okay. And when I go by them, I like them for two reasons. One is you get me on those belt roads and I get lost. I have no idea where I am. And so seeing a big set of onion rings or magnolia leaves or whatever they are, that helps me a lot. But also the color is the color of our clay. The red clay is what makes the Carolina Piedmont distinctive. And he's captured that there with this thing. It's called grandiflora. Mm-hmm. And so that's the formal name. And that's what Dan Morrill's talking about. But the same guy also did the furrow, which is the big discs that are along South Boulevard.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because Jennifer wanted to know about it. She pointed out that those big discs are very similar to the onion rings, and they're the same guy.
Right.
You know, and you're not supposed to call those sand dollars.
You're not supposed to call them potato chips.
Okay. You know, one of the things that's interesting about what Tom's saying about these abstract pieces, and I like abstract art, but you got to explain it. And if you take the Hugh McManaway statue on Queens Road, you know, that's a human form. Or the Captain Jack monument that's down on the Little Sugar Creek Greenway. You know, Captain Jack's on a horse. We all know what a horse is. We see horses.
See, I never knew what that was until you were on the show last time. I thought it was Paul Revere, and I thought, why is Paul Revere?
Oh, no, there's going to be more statues along the Greenway that represent historical people who have made a difference in our community.
So Captain Jack was?
Captain Jack rode
to Philadelphia.
He took some documents.
The
mech deck. He took them. Oh, I'm not going to get into the mech deck. I'm not going to get into that controversy. He took some documents to the Continental Congress in May of 1775. Some say it was the Mecklenburg Resolve. Some that Mecklenburg. I'm not going to do it. But still, you know what it is. It's a horse. Where Tom has to explain this thing at. Well, I mean, that's one of the challenges.
It doesn't fit the architecture of the neighborhood. But
tell me about the sand dollars or the circles at the Scaly Bark Link station. It's done by the same guy who did the onion rings at Randolph and Wendover.
And they symbolize the discs that you would have on a harrow that would come behind a plow and weed out.
Did you know that, Tom? Did you know that before you asked Mr. Google?
I thought they were potato chips.
Well, because Lance is nearby.
I still don't get it.
Now, speaking of discs, there's another disc that Jennifer points out, and that is a circular disc at Trade and Tryon. Now, that disc used to rotate, and it looks like a bas-relief of a city on its side. But I'm not sure what it is. Now, they fixed it into a fixed position. It no longer rotates. Why doesn't it rotate, and what is it?
It didn't rotate. It did rotate, and it threatened to take out small children. And
so, do you know Joe Martin tried to make it into a yo-yo?
Really?
Yeah, they strung this rope all the way from the top of the building down to that thing and pretended it was a yo-yo, and the wind came. You know, the wind does a lot of great. That's what happened with the wind. The wind he's right. It became absolutely dangerous.
The wind uptown is really rough, but there's a whole folder on the disc at the library.
And it's called the Pomodoro something.
Yes,
isn't it?
It has a very, but we just know it as the disc.
Isn't a Pomodoro, isn't that Italian for tomato or something like that?
I think that's a little bit different.
All right.
The same artist did a sculpture that has some of the same flavor on the patio at the United Nations.
Really?
So y'all go out to the United Nations this afternoon and check that out.
You didn't bring up Maya Lin's topo.
Well, I was trying to avoid it. For those of you who have not lived here long enough, there were two competing pieces of public art that were supposed to be put in front of the
Have you driven out there lately to see what that looks like?
It plowed it over, didn't they?
Yeah. How much did they pay for a topo?
Well, let's talk about what it is first. People don't know. Maya Lin designed the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, which is a stunning piece of design. And then she also won the commission to do the topiary sculpture.
When they turned down Gumby.
Yeah, when they turned down the Gumby statue, which would still be here. But the topiaries were simply shrubs.
Round shrubs.
At different levels that were supposed to be illustrative of a bouncing ball going down the median between the two driveways. And as I understand it, from the air, you could tell what it is. From the ground, you really couldn't unless they turned on the sprinkler system, which gave it a mist. Well, if you do that a lot, you kill the trees. So what's up with that?
You know, there was some idea about taking it to the UNCC campus.
Yeah.
But they figured they couldn't do it. It was too big.
Really?
Yeah, so it's gone.
It had grown by then. It started out.
That brings a question from George up for debate here. George, welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead.
How much public art is left in Charlotte? I understand that most projects have to have so much set aside for art, and a lot of it disappears after a time.
Well, you know that there's a lot of public art in Charlotte, and there's a real issue about what do you mean by public art. Public art doesn't have to be governmental art. In fact, some that we've already been talking about is privately initiated, like the disc at the square. When you go around, it is remarkable. If you go to the Queens College campus, if you go to the UNCC campus, UNCC has a remarkable collection of public art. There is a tremendous amount of public art in this community. Water features, for example, that's public art. One of the definitions of public art is it's something that should touch the public emotionally, and that basically they don't have to buy a ticket for it. They don't have to punch a clock. They simply go and see it and interact with it.
So the Science Council on their website has a walking tour of some of the uptown public art.
And all the public libraries have public art.
All right. The public art that's on the square, there are four statues on pedestals on the square, Trade and Tryon. Is that not public art?
It's definitely public art.
What's that all about?
Well, you can't – one thing, you better –
And why is it there?
Well, it's there to symbolize the history of the city. I'll let
There are now explanatory plaques. There are a couple of them there. So as you go up and explore, you can see right there what the sculptor – and, again, it's Raymond Caskey, the same guy that did the Queen Charlotte statue out at the airport. One of them is an African-American guy holding a big spike hammer, and he stands for transportation, which today is all different kinds of modes. But 150 years ago, African-Americans did a lot of the building of the railroads, which is the thing that connected us to the global economy. So that's one. Another is a woman who's holding a textile bobbin. And she symbolizes industry, which is still going on around here. But a century ago, that was the textile industry, and women were the main workers in that.
And those bobbins are echoed down the street in front of the Bobcat Arena.
Right, indeed. Mm-hmm. And you go on around, and there's a guy panning for gold, and he stands for commerce, which today is banking. But back before 1849, before the California Gold Rush, Charlotte was the gold-producing center for the United States.
You've left out death art.
There's death art?
Well, public art, death art. I mean, there's cemeteries are full of death art. There are angels. There's shrouded urns. Do you know the John King monument in Elmwood Cemetery?
No.
He got killed by an elephant in September 1880.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was a circus worker. There's an elephant on the marker.
Okay.
But death art is a big public art feature, truly.
The square. That's Trade and Tryon.
Right.
Why is it called the square when it's not a square? It's just an intersection. It's not a square like it would be you'd see in Savannah. It's just an intersection. Why is it called the square?
It's the town square.
Yeah, but why isn't it a square?
The folks who settled here, a lot of them were Scots-Irish, came down from southern Pennsylvania, northern Maryland. And if you go there, every little town has a place where the streets meet, same as it is here, but there's a little notch out of each corner.
Okay.
It's not a square in the middle of the intersection. It's a square that's notched out.
We've kind of done that.
The thought is that originally when there were a few log houses around there, there was that kind of square. And indeed, in the last 20 years, as new buildings have been built around Trade and Tryon streets, that notching effect happens, and it is now a gathering place for the city.
Why is the plaza called the plaza when it is not a plaza? It is a road.
Back around the turn of the last century, the chic thing in the world was New York City. And so the Plaza Hotel, I think, is the inspiration for that. The reason I think that is I lived in for a while, and I live on the plaza, so I've thought about this a lot. But I lived in Youngstown, Ohio for a while. And in Youngstown, Ohio, there was a plaza, there was also a Broadway, and there was a Fifth Avenue. Mm-hmm. There was no Fourth Avenue or Third Avenue, but that New York
to
cachet.
To emulate New York.
That's part of the elite feeling of the suburbs.
There's a wonderful piece of public art in the 100 block of West Moorhead Street. It's a fountain that was used to water horses, mules and oxen, and it's right there. It was donated to the city by the Humane Society in 1911.
Where is this now?
100 block of West Moorhead Street.
All right. We only have 4 minutes left, so lots of short answers. Joshua tweets, what is the design on the side of the CAT station? To me, it looks like a hurricane. I guess that's the downtown.
Oh, well.
No one knows. Okay. We'll look it up. You call the library. They'll look it up. Bertha tweets, please talk about the statue on the corner of Queens Road and Providence Road. That's the statue art. Hugh McManaway, is that his name?
Yeah, he was a guy. He was an interesting man. He used to speak in verse. He said, no, you're not liable if you read the Bible. And he would stand and point at the traffic signal. He would twirl around and point at it and time it perfectly. And he's a memorable figure. He was somebody that was unusual.
The neighborhood put it up.
Well, the McManaway house is on just down the road from there. Yeah. His family, they moved that house from Charlotte to that location.
Scott tweets, is it true that the city ordinance dictates that a percentage of all public money be public building money be dedicated to public art? That is true, right?
That I believe that program is still in place.
Candace on Facebook says, regarding the O sculptures, the onion rings, I remember people being very upset about a couple of mature trees that had to be cut to develop that property, and this work was created to symbolize those trees. Going back to Elizabeth, you said Elizabeth was named after what?
Elizabeth College. It was a Lutheran school for girls. It was known. It had a wonderful musical conservatory.
Dilworth got its name from?
Edward Dilworth Latta, who was the guy that built the trolley system and built the neighborhood.
And Myers Park. Why is it called
Myers? Myers family owned about 1,000 acres of cotton land out there, and they hired John Nolan to turn it into a suburb.
And their son-in-law was the developer.
We have the 277 loop around the backside or the east side of Charlotte, and one part of it's called the John Belk Freeway. The other is called the Brookshire Freeway. Why do we have to have two names for one road?
Politics.
I got to honor those mayors.
And in fact, the John Belk side begins life as what? I can't think of the name of it. If you keep following it out past
Wilkinson Boulevard,
and the other side becomes
right,
the Brookshire.
Right, he was the state highway commissioner at the time.
Why was Charlotte the epicenter of wrestling at one time? Anybody know?
Rednecks.
Why does NASCAR here?
Charlotte was also the epicenter of country music at one point in the early
That's because we had the Hotel Charlotte and there, and Victor Records would come down here.
Well, why did we give it up to Nashville?
Well, the reason that we got it was that WBT radio, which I probably shouldn't mention on this station, was the second radio station to sign on in the South, and it was in the center of all of these textile mills.
Wait a minute. Who's the first?
WSB in Atlanta.
They were the first?
Yep.
I'll bet you the folks at WBT would beg to differ with you on that because they claim to be the second station in the country after KDKA.
Okay.
I don't want to defend these people
over here.
But I must. I worked there too long. It's inculcated. The history is inculcated into my very fiber.
But what began to happen was that the country music stars and folks who were going to become country music stars came here. Mm-hmm. And so when RCA started to do field recording sessions, they came here Nashville.
Is it true that Alexander, Brevard, Caldwell, and Davidson streets used to be A, B, C, and D streets?
That's correct. And then they were changed, I think, sometime in the late, towards the turn of the century.
And all of those people have a reason for being famous.
Most of, the Alexander family, as we all know, and John Brevard, they were, and Davidson, they were all signers of the Meg Deck, or they played a major role in the history of Charlotte.
And to take it out of uptown, very quickly, Ballantyne, who was John J. Delaney? That's a famous street down there. Anybody know? Quickly.
Looked this up yesterday. He was a developer and president of the Home Builders Association in Charlotte. There's an award named after him, but he was a builder in the 1960s.
Sheila Bumgarner with the library, Dan Morrill from UNC Charlotte, Tom Hatchett from the Levine Museum of the New South. Thank you all.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3 mornings and evenings. The First Alert weather team forecasts weather for the region. WBTV First Alert mobile weather app brings interactive radar and up-to-date forecasts. WBTV on your side.
And coming up on the Diane Reem Show in just a few minutes, the Justice Department sues to block the merger of American Airlines and U.S. Airways. North Carolina adopts a new voter ID law, which we'll be talking about on Monday. And a judge rejects New York City's stop and frisk policy. It's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Reem Show, the National Hour first, the International Hour second. A panel of journalists joins Diane to analyze all those stories and take your calls and more. And that's coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Reem Show. We're going to come back and talk about a unique experience for young people made possible by the Blumenthal to see the Lion King.
It can be hard to be a journalist. The hours are long, the pay's often lousy. But what if you wrote something and Hollywood came calling?
What was the last movie you produced?
High and Dry.
Who paid for that?
CFDC.
What's your middle name? What's your middle name?
Leon?
Shoot him. He's an American spy.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Writers take their material to the movies. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I want to remind people that if you want to hear more about some of the oddities that we were talking about in the first part of the program about Charlotte, you can check out WFAE's podcast, A Trifling Place, with Charlotte newcomer and reporter Tasnim Shama at WFAE.org, including a story about the statues on the four corners of the square. We will also post some of the phone numbers and information that were tossed out in the course of that conversation on our website later today. Many of today's Broadway shows are amazing for what they're able to pull off on stage, none more so than Disney's The Lion King. It's a show that works for adults and children from its opening moments, thanks in large measure to the wonderful, bigger-than-life-size puppets created by director Julie Taymor. All of that to say, children should be exposed to this show. It will whet their appetite for future theatrical experiences, but not all children can afford the price of a ticket, quite frankly. Blumenthal Performing Arts, which is housing The Lion King through September the 1st, set out to do something about that. They partnered with Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools to bring 1,000 Charlotte area kids to see the play. And joining us to tell us more about this, quite frankly, unusual gesture is Cindy Rice, Vice President of Development for the Blumenthal. Welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Alan Davis has risen through the ranks from his original internship to his position as program coordinator for Freedom School Partners. Thank you for joining us. Amber Heath is now a Freedom School intern at Highland Renaissance. And Jayla Hallman is a rising sixth grader at Highland Renaissance, which, of course, is part of the Freedom Schools. I was going to begin with a question to the Blumenthal about their reasoning behind this, but I think we should begin with Alan with this question, because I'm not sure people are aware of, I was not aware of, Freedom Schools. What are Freedom Schools and what is Freedom School Partners?
Freedom Schools is a six-week literacy program designed for and led by college servant leader interns for children who most need but can least afford quality summer programming. What we strive to do at Freedom Schools is to give our scholars three things. Literacy skills to help them in their classrooms when they return back to school in the falls, but character traits and character strengths to help them know that they're important and know that they matter in life, because we know that you can have all the grades in the world, but if you don't think you're important, you don't use your skills. And then the third thing that we do at Freedom School Partners is create a community of caring for those scholars, to let them know that there's a world bigger than themselves and there's a world out there that cares about their well-being and what they do. And so at Freedom School Partners, we put on these Freedom School programs around the city here in Charlotte at 19 sites serving about 1,200 children. And so it's really about getting children excited about books, excited about what their life can be, and exposing them to a community around them that believes in them and that will support them throughout that.
I got on your website this morning and just looked at Freedom Schools, what they say about themselves. You say that our community challenge is that every child has the potential to succeed, not every child has the opportunity. And that's the bottom line here, isn't it?
Yes, sir, it is.
And further it says, Freedom School Partners give children three fundamental resources needed to develop their potential: literacy skills, character strengths, and a community that believes in them. We believe in children, you say, so that children will believe in themselves. Wow.
Yes. It's a powerful mission, and it's what's important for our community, because if we better our scholars today and our community today, it makes for a better Charlotte and a better world tomorrow.
You started as an intern in this program because college students come in, and you're a college student, Amber. You're an intern now with the program, and you started as an intern. Describe to me the impact, the two of you, the impact that this has on the young people with whom you work.
I would say that it has a really, really huge impact. It's hard to describe the power of that impact. I've witnessed students who are so far away from books. They don't have a connection to that. They have no reason to read, and we kind of inspire that into them to let them know that if you do read, readers are leaders. It's very important for you to decide that you want to make a difference. So it's kind of like we teach the literacy, and we also teach the character building to say that we're here. We're here to work together as a community. We're here to do that by reading and being more educated, and also by helping our brother and sister.
And you've been with this program for a while, and you've worked your way up from intern, Alan. So you've seen a lot of students come through. What happens to these kids?
What happens is they're exposed to college students and community people that believe in them. Many of our scholars don't have that every single day at home. And so for 6 weeks over the summer, they're given people, and people are placed in their lives that love them every single day, that believe in them and are encouraging them. And one of the things that I see most is the confidence that our scholars walk away with. They believe that they are important. Freedom School focuses around a general theme of I can make a difference. And each week has a sub theme of self, family, community, country, world, and with hope, education, and action. So each week the books are focused on how can you make a difference in yourself? How can you make a difference in your family? How can you believe in your community and your country to become better and to change what's around you? And how can you help your brother and sister, like Amber said? And so our scholars walk away believing in themselves. And that's what's important in life. Like I said, you can have all the skills in the world, but if you don't believe in yourself and know that you are important and that you matter, you don't really bring your skills to the world. And so that's what we encourage our scholars, to bring themselves to who they are. And with the college students, which is why it's so powerful. As I was a college student, I struggled to know what I was doing in life myself. Like, why am I in college? What, I'm just going to college because I'm supposed to go to college. But Freedom School gave me a place where I knew my gifts mattered, where I could pour into a scholar who was just as confused and just as lost and know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, to know that there's a purpose for you and what your life holds. And so for me, seeing that every single summer as I grew from an intern to site coordinator has continually been a blessing to see that, because I know that the impact that I have on the scholars and that we've put in our program for the scholars around the city will change not only Charlotte, but will change the world, like we had Jayla.
So people listening to this conversation may be scratching their heads thinking, well, how does the Lion King figure into all this? And we're going to get to that. But before we get to that part of it, Cindy Rice, you're with the Blumenthal. The Blumenthal brings in, I can't even count how many shows you guys bring in every year in all the theaters that you have around town. Why bring kids to the Lion King? Why that show? What makes it so special?
Well, I think for you and for listeners who have listened to what Freedom School is all about, that that gives, I think, an understanding about why we felt this show was so perfect. The Lion King is really, its messages and its themes are very empowering. The message is you matter, what you do affects the tribe, live up to your potential. So from the standpoint of the messaging and the timing for the show, and the fact that these children, many of whom are children of color, would see actors on the stage who look like them, we really felt that this was the perfect show to bring them.
And this kind of came around serendipitously. This was your idea. This was not hatched at the very top. It was your idea. You took it to the very top, hoping that they would say no.
I did. I really did. I was honestly, I was so blown away by the passion at the Freedom School Jubilee last July, not this past July, but the year before, which I was invited to at the last minute by a girlfriend who needed another person at her table. And it truly was just overwhelming to me, because it was the kids and the interns, and there was a former intern at our table. And honestly, it just oozed energy and passion. So as I was standing there, I couldn't help but think, oh my gosh, this program's going to be here next summer and Lion King is here next summer and it would be the perfect show. So I was nervous about doing it because it was expensive to fund that many tickets.
I think people need to understand this. They assume that an organization like Blumenthal Performing Arts brings in a show. It's their theater. It's their mm-hmm. seats. If they want to put 5,000 people in the theater, go ahead. No, it doesn't work that way. You have to pay the bill.
We do.
The producers in New York.
Right. We don't actually own those seats right. when the Lion King comes in. Disney's The Lion King owns those seats. So we actually purchased the tickets for these children. And that ticket purchase amounted to over $60,000 for those 1,000 children. But
so where did the money come from?
It came from all of the Charlotte community.
And that's why, after you got the idea, you hoped they would turn you down because you knew yes. raising that kind of money in this atmosphere wasn't going to be easy.
Yes,
how
exactly.
How did it turn out? Was it easy?
Well, it was truly serendipitous. And we were so fortunate because at the moment we were ready to pull the cord and open up this effort to raise the money. There was an announcement made through Power to Give, which is a crowdfunding site that the Arts and Science Council started, and they announced a dollar-for-dollar match that Wells Fargo was offering to ASC partners. And as an ASC partner, that made us eligible for that match. So we just directed our gifts to Power to Give, and it actually was incredibly successful and seemed almost too easy. But I think it really resonated with people. I mean, people knew, they knew that if they gave $65, that meant a child could see this show. I think the fact that they had such a direct connection, that really helped. And it was almost easy.
Let me talk to Jayla here. Jayla Hallman's a rising sixth grader. She has gone to the Freedom School at Highland Renaissance. Had you ever seen a Broadway show before?
No.
What are your thoughts? Be a critic.
Okay. Well, it was really great, and it did teach a lesson, like she said. It was about how the little boy, he was growing up, he was getting older, and he was going, like, he was trying to be brave, and his dad was telling him to stay in one place, but he was everywhere, and then so when he went, it was, like, where the hyenas were and stuff like that,
yeah.
and they were getting him, and then he had a uncle, and his uncle was very rude. Well, in my way, he was very rude because he was trying to take over. And my most favorite part was when the Lion King, he died, because I like how the action was and the scene was when the lightning was coming.
Now, did you know the story before you went to the play?
Well, I've seen the movie before.
You've seen the movie, the cartoon, the animated movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty close to that. And it's pretty mm-hmm. what amazed me about the show, and it still does, are the puppets that are bigger than life. And particularly when they open the show and they're coming through the audience down the aisles. What was that like? Did you know that was coming? Did you know that was going to happen?
No.
So when that started to happen, what was that like?
It was amazing. And I was like,
because I'm told a lot of kids really on the edge of their seats for the whole show. And this is not unusual. This is not just your group. It's what made this show so successful, that you can literally hear people going, as things happen on the stage and in the audience with these characters. What did you talk about with your friends when it was over?
Well, I wasn't really talking because it amazed me so much I didn't have time to talk.
You couldn't quite process it. And Amber, I'm surprised about this. I read yesterday that that this was also your first Broadway musical.
It was. It really was. And I'm ashamed to say it almost. But I don't know why. It's kind of like I knew of The Lion King. I knew of things that I wanted to go and see, but I never fully pursued it. And that could be in part because growing up, that wasn't something that many people in my family went to go see. I am a product of a single parent family, a household, and we didn't really talk about going to see Broadway shows. So I think that it also taught me to explore these things and step out even more than what I do now.
You know, aside from the themes of The Lion King that Cindy mentioned, which are valuable and actually are part of what you teach at Freedom Schools, that you matter, that what you do affects others, that the tribe needs you and they want you to live up to your potential, all seriously wonderful messages. And I'm sure that's what a lot of things that you've already talked about this, Alan, that you concentrate on. What does the exposure to this form of entertainment, live theater, what has it done for you, Amber, who never saw a Broadway show before? And what has it done for you, Jayla, who have seen television and you've seen movies, and now you've seen this? What's the difference? What would you tell your friends the difference is?
Well, it's better to go to a Broadway show for me because, like, you get to see it live instead of just watching it on TV. Like, it's actually live, and they make the characters look really real.
And for me, I'll say that it's so much deeper than the actual show. It was a wonderful experience for me. But the whole time I was there, I was thinking that there are some people out here in the world who actually are concerned, who care, who aren't concerned with making a profit, because I knew that it would be a very expensive venture. And because of that selflessness, because of those hard donating efforts, it really was something that exposed our scholars to be able to say, you know what, when I grow up, I want to be Simba, or I want to be one of the lioness dancers. I think that that is so powerful that if they're exposed to that early, they can make that as one of their goals. And we have many, many talented young people mm-hmm. who are now exposed to a whole new outlet, a whole new world, so to speak.
Alan.
Yes, and I was to share that The Lion King was the culminating event. What we did throughout this summer was we exposed the scholars to what careers were available through being a part of a Broadway show. So we were able to bring the level three and level two scholars to the Booth Playhouse and see about puppetry and to learn about what it meant to produce a performance and what it meant to write a play. But then we also had the level ones doing leaf and stem activities throughout the summer where they learned about the circle of life and what it meant for animals to eat other animals and then die and to live in it. So we were able to, with this one event of Lion King, really expose the scholars to different aspects through science and technology, through career readiness, all these different pieces that ended with the performance of The Lion King.
So there are 19 Freedom Schools around the Charlotte area. You also brought in some kids from Bennettsville whose opportunities to see right. this kind of entertainment are even more limited than in Charlotte because they don't have theaters. They only have, what, two elevators in the whole town?
The director told me, actually, it's one elevator in the entire county and no escalators. So the 200 students who came from Bennettsville rode an escalator for the first time
Is this the first of an ongoing series, maybe, down the road?
We hope so.
Cindy
we
Rice,
sure
Vice
so.
President of Development for Bloom with Fall Performing Arts, Alan Davis with Freedom School Partners, and Amber Heath also with them as an intern, Jayla Hallman, a rising sixth grader at Highland Renaissance. Thank you all.